Good Thursday there, football fans. It is almost April, not quite, the last day of March. This is the Soccer Central podcast. James Sharman here alongside John Molinaro. J-Mo.
How are you?
Are you back from your international excursions, i.e. a lot of time on the couch the last few days?
Yeah, I was watching a lot of games over the last 4 or 5 days, whatever it was. So it's good to be out with the outside people.
Living and breathing again. We'll get to some of those games later in today's show. Talking to Rob Gale, Canada's under-20 head coach as well. They had a famous win against England last week as well. We had Rob on recently, and he was talking about the future looking pretty bright at that age grade. And, well, I guess he was right, because that was an enormous win.
Very impressive result. Very impressive result.
We'll also look ahead briefly to the weekend as the domestic leagues across Europe fire back into action, into the run-ins for sure, starting this weekend. But let's start with, this past week, some sad news for the football world, really sad news. Johan Cruyff, one of the all-time greats, some would say the greatest player, but certainly one of the best visionaries our games has ever enjoyed, died suffering from cancer the last little while. A man that knows him better than most, a man that began as a fan of Johan Cruyff, became a teammate, and then a close friend, is one of my favorite people in the football world, Thomas Rongen. TR, how you doing, pal?
Darms, John, how you guys doing up in Ontario, where I enjoyed myself for about 2 years at Toronto FC, but I'm glad I'm back in the... Actually, I had a swim in my pool. I don't know if you guys can see
That is low,
that's
man.
Rubbing it in, TR.
That
come
is
on.
Low. TR's down in Florida once again now, moving around, but doing some worth of being sport. Was covering the Guatemala-US game as well, actually, recently. So great to see you back on the TV there, pal. It's where you belong, mate. If not on the sidelines, then it's certainly on the TV set. Let's talk about Johan Cruyff. Growing up as a Dutchman, what did he mean to you and your pals as footballers?
Well, he was, at that time, the pillar of Ajax. And this is a little bit before they became very popular, when they won 3 European championships in the late 60s and early 70s. But Johan was Amsterdam. Johan was from a neighborhood that didn't have a lot of money, and people could really relate to him well, outside of the fact that he was a genius on the field. He was a guy that everybody in the Netherlands felt was the savior for Dutch football. And clearly, when I grew up in Amsterdam, Ajax was my team. I went through the youth programs. So you woke up with a Cruyff T-shirt. You went to bed with a Cruyff T-shirt, so to speak, because he was at that time already a legend at a very, very young age.
TR, for people who, you know, maybe were a little bit young and didn't have the benefit of seeing Johan Cruyff in his prime, what was he like? What made him so special on the pitch? What made him such a great player?
Well, first and foremost, with his slight frame, and, you know, later hopefully we can go talk about the Barcelonas of the world. He was a 120. He was skinny. He was faster with the ball than without, which you rarely see of players. Maybe George Best comes to mind as well. The acceleration, getting away from people. But I think first and foremost was his incredible vision, keen understanding of what the game required, thinking ahead, which he always talked about to me as well. He loved Fischer, he loved Kasparov, the chess players. He always talked to me when he played the game at a very high level in terms of chess, which he played 4 or 5 times a week. Socially, he would go into the city and just pick fights with people. All right, bring it on. All right, let's play chess. And he said, here I learn how to move ahead 2, 3, or 4 steps. And that made him so special outside of his grace, outside of his great technical ability, outside of that great curler, you know, the outside of the foot, the inside of the foot that we all know so well in the later stage of his career when people finally started noticing Johan Cruyff. But he had certain special things that not a lot of other players have, and that's why he's probably in the top 3 best players ever, because he just sets himself apart from so many other players in regard to his mindset. He was smart. In terms of his physicality, yes, he was small, but he had a low center of gravity. He was fast. He could take a hit as well. Technically superb. And we just talked about his tactical understanding and intelligence of the game was just so far ahead of other people.
Now, you played with him and the LA Aztecs. Let me ask you, as a teammate, was he easy to play with, or was it intimidating, hard to play with?
I'll tell you two stories, Jordan Sharms, that sums him up a little bit, but then also, you know, I show you the softer side of Cruyff. After 1 week in practice, he came up to me and said, "Thomas, you're okay. You're not that good of a player. Just win the ball and give it to me and just stand still after this. That's all you need to do." And you know what? I was pretty bright, too. I went, well, yeah, that makes sense. I'll be just a yelling Nations and let him do the attacking side of the football side, which he obviously did very well. Our first game in the Coliseum, another tough moment for me. But again, it was a learning lesson, not only for me, but for his teammates. We lost 2-1 against the Cosmos. And Quinella played a give-and-go with Romero, a great Paraguayan player. And I didn't stay with the runner. I didn't stay with Quinella. He finished. Thanks for coming. 1 minute later, game over. Walked in the locker room in front of all the players. He literally takes me by the neck. He pins me against the wall and says, "You know what? In the old days, when we played for bonuses, you would take a food off my children's plate. Don't let it ever happen again." And it never did. I now became conscious of staying with runners off the ball. And you know, that was Johan. The soft side, real quick, he would drive through LA, D.C. He would stop at random fields where kids really didn't know him. And he would, at that time, without naming that, he would show him the Cruyff move. And then many years later, people dubbed a move from Johan behind the leg, which is so famous, as the Cruyff move. I mean, you're talking about a legacy. There's kids right now that I walk up to, and they're doing the Cruyff move. How many players have a move, you know, called after their name? So that was pretty cool. He had a very soft side as well. He wanted the game to develop in his country and did everything both on and off the field to do that.
You lived with him for a part of a time, did you not? I mean, from what I was reading, he took you in and you kind of lived with his family for about 5 or 6 months?
Yes, I did, John. I did. Again, talking about gracious people that picked me up from the airport. Johan Cruyff is picking me up, carrying my bags with his wife and three kids when they were still young. And putting me in their house and go, "In a week, you'll find something." Well, 6 months later, I'm still there. And there's probably not too many people, players, teammates, who can say they've lived 24-7 for 6 months with Johan Cruyff. That was just an incredible experience because he's such a great human being, which a lot of people don't know. And yes, he's critical. Yes, he's stubborn. Yes, he's brilliant. But he's also a very, very good husband. A great father. I remember a story when we went to Jordy Cruyff's first game. He was 5 years old. Wow. And about 10 minutes in, Johan looks at me and goes, "He's going to have a tough time with my last name because he's absolutely useless." Thank God he went on to have carved out a pretty decent career for himself. But, that, you know, that was Johan. Just a great. We lived next to the Rockefellers. We didn't have a pool, so we swam in the Rockefellers' house. Wow. And we had brunch on Sunday with the Kennedys, who lived on the other side.
Holy
jeez.
Just to
give you an idea where we were exactly.
Hey, TR, can you tell the story then? You must regale us about your experience with Ted Kennedy and coffee. Remember that one you told us?
Yeah.
It's a classic.
As you guys know, and maybe your listeners don't, one of the reasons why Johan Cruyff came to the United States was his wife and the three kids were held hostage for about 6 hours in their own house. And then they negotiated a deal. And they went to the United States knowing that they would be somewhat anonymous, which they were. You know, Johan loved to walk through Georgetown and nobody knew him. But they had two killing guard dogs with them. So, you know, 3 weeks, I keep going home with Johan out of respect. I didn't have a car. And his wife one day went, it's just typical blunt Dutch, she went, "Are you gay?" I go, "No." She goes, "You never go out." I go, "Well, out of respect, I'll go with Johan." She goes, "Johan, Did you win a car last year?" He goes, "Yeah, I scored a goal of the year in the NASL. Well, give it to TR." I go, "All right, thanks. I got a car. Excellent." So I go out after the next game, get a little hammered from home around 3 a.m.,
a little.
Try to open the door, and I look at these two dogs and go, "Shit, they're either going to kill me, although they knew me, or they're going to wake everybody up." So I decided to fall asleep behind the house. I get woken up around 8 or 9 next morning by a guy that had no idea who he was. He goes, "I know you live here. Come next door and have a cup of coffee." So Johan comes up to me And he goes, "Do you know what it was?" I go, "No." He said, "That was Ted Kennedy." I go, "Really?
Oh, jeez.
Did he sleep next to me? Because Ted likes to drink as well." "No, no, no. He just picked you up. You know, a good guy." So Ted actually became really, he liked me for whatever reason. And he would go, "Come on, let's go out. We have a driver. Don't worry about it. We can drink." I go, "Ted, all right, let's roll. Let's do it." So as a very young guy, I had some incredible experiences, obviously, and shit, and the Rockefellers, the Kennedys, as a 22-year-old. That was pretty amazing.
Amazing. You're living with Johan Cruyff. Your drinking buddy is Ted Kennedy, only in the life of Thomas Rundgren. Back to Cruyff here. And would it be fair to say that on and off the field, this might be the greatest visionary the game's ever seen? You mentioned earlier about Barcelona and what he brought to that club, which in turn has been brought to the world's game, the 4-3-3, the total football. You know, without Johan Cruyff, football would be very different, wouldn't it?
Yes. In 1999, again, not too many people know that he was voted in Europe the player of the century. You know, we're talking about Beckenbauer. We're talking about George Best. We're talking about some Di Stefano, Puskas. We're talking about some incredible players in that whole sense. And, you know, speak that way, and I still feel that he is probably the most influential soccer person in the last six decades, last 60 years. He showed me a notebook, handwritten, which he said to me, "Thomas, I've never shown this to anybody, ever." He opens it up, it's handwritten in pencil, and the first line is, "Screw, well, as was a sort of word, the 4-4-2 and the long ball." And then it went on to explain his philosophy regarding attacking dominant technical football out of a 4-3-3. It was 1967, and he convinced Rinus Michels to adopt that philosophy. He went actually out and scouted three or four players that nobody really knows about to bring to the team in order to execute an incredible system. And boom, here they are, won three European championships, late 50s, early 70s, all of a sudden, in 74, everybody's going, "Oh my God, Clockwork Orange, total football." That foundation was laid in the mid-60s by Johan Cruyff. He takes that with him to Barcelona. Actually, he had drawings of La Masia. La Masia wasn't built at that time. Johan was the architect of La Masia. He had drawings about, you know, about dorms, about education, about training fields, about, you know, the youngest players are the furthest away. They turn the furthest away from the first team. They're going to work their way up. And one other thing at the end of it was very important. Size does not matter. Intelligence does. And you know what? If it wasn't for his philosophy, probably Messi would have never ended up at La Masia. Mm-hmm. Xavi and Iniesta, in any other country where it's all about athleticism and strength and power, probably would not have played because of Johan Cruyff as a player initially, but later as a manager, which again, not too many players have. Maybe Beckenbauer is the only other one that on a high level was a great coach and also, you know, as a player was obviously a tremendous player, but he didn't revolutionize the game. You look at the current system of all high-level teams. There's a few exceptions here and there, but all the high-level teams, they all play out of a hybrid 4-3-3. That might be a 4-2-3-1. That might be a 4-1-2, as Barcelona plays, and three on top. But everybody... And this started, guys, five decades ago. I mean, what an influence. And Barcelona, this Barcelona, modern Barcelona, is obviously Cruyff. And his coaches that played for him, that he was a mentor of, and the names are very obvious, they still play according to Johan Cruyff's methodology and philosophy. And that's, what else do you say? You're right. The best ever.
It's a great point, and the fact that, you know, so many people now who have discovered soccer in the last decade or so look at Barcelona as being the reason, you know, they reinvented the game under Pep Guardiola, and to a point they did, but let's be honest, like you say there, it already began in the 60s with Johan Cruyff deciding, you know, how football should be played. TR, we're out of time. Thank you so much for this, mate. I know it's obviously a tough week for you, saying farewell to your friend, but as always, great job, and we look forward to seeing you as your media career takes on new heights. Thanks, pal.
Thank you, John. Thanks, Charms.
Cheers.
That is Thomas Rundgren. Please follow TR on Twitter at TRundgren_. Yeah, you know, I never got to see Cruyff play. It was just before my time. right. heard all about him, and of course hear about the Pelés and the Maradonas. Less so at that time of Johan Cruyff, but as time goes on, I think you realize that he very much should be spoken of in the same ilk as those guys, and perhaps in many ways more important than those guys, given what he did off the field as well.
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, the word visionary was thrown out, you know, a lot in the days after Johan Cruyff passed away, and I think that's quite true. He, you know, helped revolutionize and change the way the game was played, and you can see his influence in the modern Barcelona and the whole sort of way that they've approached, and his legacy lives on in guys like Pep Guardiola, and I even think in players, in like Messi and Ronaldo, because Cruyff was the type of player who dared to be different, and he would try things, and he wasn't sort of, he really stretched the physical boundaries of what was possible on a pitch, you know, trying new things and trying different things, and I think you still see that through guys like Messi and Ronaldo. I think that's a direct legacy to Johan Cruyff. So, you know, I don't think there's no question he was a very strong-willed person and someone who really saw himself as sort of the moral compass of soccer, which can, you know, it was a little grating at times to hear him speak about that. But, you know, he was, there's no question you can talk with regards to his influence. He was quite rightly one of the most influential figures in the history of the game.
Well, he could be prickly, but you look at the way the game has progressed or, you know, changed over the years. There was a long part, international football especially, where it became very defensive and where players weren't encouraged to try things. And it was about the team and the result over the performance. And it must have driven him crazy.
Oh, nuts, batty.
Nuts. Because he believed in winning, obviously, but winning the right way. And his whole mandate was, you know, well, the best defense really is a good offense. Try and get the ball off us.
Right.
You know, and I really respect that. So when he would, you know, sit back, I'm sure, and watch some of the older German sides dominate world football playing, you know, let's face it, it's a boring style of football. Mm. Successful, but boring.
Right.
For many, many years. It's changed now, of course.
Sure.
It must have grated and thought, you know, what he implemented back in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
And 80s is for naught.
Yeah, and he was not, it has to be said, he was not the greatest fan of Italian football as well. Right. He had a lot of negative things to say about Italian teams. And I remember to this day, you know, when he was coaching Barcelona in the 1994 Champions League final, you know, they were playing AC Milan in that final. And, you know, this was the dream team of Barcelona, and they were heavily favored in that game. And he had a lot of negative things to say. He was talking a lot of smack in the build-up to that final. Especially against Fabio Capello, who was coaching AC Milan at the time. And history remembers that AC Milan beat them 4-0. So he was kind of shown up a little bit. But yeah, he was, as I said, he believed what he believed in. And, you know, he was very strong-willed in his opinion. And he really thought, you know, there was one way to play. And, you know, results mattered, but you had to play what he saw as the right way. And he stuck by that.
Maybe he should have won a World Cup, you know? Perhaps.
What do you mean?
78?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well, listen, I mean, it was...
it's a wonderful team.
They came close in 74 too, right? Yeah, because they were up in that game, and then they kind of got a little arrogant, and they were kind of toying around with the Germans and then let him back into the game. So, mm-hmm. You know, that was his big chance. This was probably something we should have asked Thomas again, but he, you know, he didn't play in the 78 team because he pulled out, so it was... Always wondering if he...
So sad,
you know,
why he pulled out. I mean, TRF mentioned there, perhaps, why.
Yeah, so it would have been sort of get more insight into that. But, having not won the World Cup, I don't think that hurts his influence.
Well, that's a great point, because people criticize Messi and Ronaldo for never won. It's such nonsense. And Cruyff's a prime example of that.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. Michel Platini never won the World Cup, and I think he's one of the best players ever. Di Stefano, the list is endless. George Best never even played in a major international tournament. I don't think so. No.
But read Google the 78 World Cup and Cruyff and why he pulled out. TR mentioned it there about the kidnapping back home,
right.
And how it, you know, clearly affected him and
rattled
him.
Yeah.
And who wouldn't it rattle?
Sure.
Simple
yeah.
as that, right? And that
absolutely
precipitated his move to the States. But he'll be missed, and his legacy is for all to see when you see great football being played around the world now. And certainly Cruyff has influenced many, many a coach around the world, you know, with his tactics and his whole, passion for the game, certainly. And maybe, who knows, maybe there's a young Johan Cruyff operating in the Canadian system, J-Mo.
Hopefully, yeah. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
That'd be all right, wouldn't it? That's just what they need, a Johan Cruyff.
That'd be great.
Well, I'll tell you what, given what's happened this past week with the U20s, there's certainly some big, big hope for the future. In England recently, U20s, they lost to England 4-1. And then they rebounded by beating a very strong, a very experienced England U20 team 2-1, which was one of the biggest results in age grade football, I think, in this country. The head coach is Rob Gale. Rob Gale joins us now from England. He's still there scouting his players. Rob, firstly, congrats on what was a huge, huge win. Now, last time you joined us in this podcast, you were very excited about some players who are very much under the radar in your talent pool. Well, this talent has just beaten England. So I guess so much for keeping it quiet.
Yes, well, thanks, firstly, for the congratulations. And really, the boys do deserve all the credit. They were terrific and responded very well, as you say, after the first sort of behind-closed-doors game. And then, obviously, the second game to play a very experienced England side. I think we were calculating over sort of 150 to 200 first-team games at the highest level for many of them. You got Winks at Tottenham and Rashford and, you know, Colquitt at Chelsea. So you got some very, very experienced players. And we took a chance with our younger boys and some of the ones, like you say, we'd referenced in the past. And they really went toe-to-toe with them in front of the crowd and the partisan crowd. And it really was a great performance.
And that's one of the points I wanted to address, Rob. You fielded, compared to the opening, 4-1 loss behind closed doors, for the second game, you fielded a younger starting lineup compared to the first game. And they obviously, the boys showed quite well. Was that deliberate to go younger? Was that sort of by design?
Yes, you know, we referenced and we thought, you know, for England's purposes, the first game really had no meaning, didn't have any coverage in the press over here. It's just counted as a sort of exhibition game, no crowds allowed. There were still some scouts from professional clubs there, but we knew they would come stronger for the crowd. You know, it was the Rashford coming out party. He hadn't been involved in a couple of years with the England teams, and now here he is at the 20s. And as we do over here in England sometimes, is we're already putting him into the first team and saying he could be going to the Euro. So it was all about Marcus Rashford, and we were very aware of that. And, you know, as staff, we spend a lot of time going across the country and we were trying to expand our systems from 15s all the way through to 20s under Tony Fonseca's national plan. And I thought, you know, as a development coach, I can talk about it all day long, but I really wanted to walk the walk and say, what have we got to lose by putting these in this environment, in this experience, give them the stadium game, give them a chance to test themselves against some very well-known, very experienced players. And, you know, if we didn't win, then nobody's expecting us ultimately to win or even get a result. I don't think, you know, against England teams, nobody's expecting Canada to come and get results, even though we've had a couple of good results in the previous cycle. So, you know, for us, it was a chance to put our faith in the young guys and not, like I say, just go and park the bus, but say, go out there and express yourself. You know, work hard. Stick to the game plan. We are very, very tactical in our approach in the build-up between games. And, you know, they've done terrifically well for themselves, the lads. They showcased themselves excellently.
I mean, you had 15-year-old kids, 16, 17-year-old kids in this match. And I guess it's obviously the downside is lack of experience and perhaps physically they might be mismatched. But would the upside be the complete lack of intimidation and that, you know, real youthful exuberance and that confidence going at this team?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I don't want to say the older lads are much different, really, because the oldest player we were taking on the field was Marco Bustos at 19 years of age, and England had actually some of their under-21s in the squad as well. So, you know, I just think that the youngsters, and we talk about this all the time in youth development, if you're a coach and you're really about development, it shouldn't be about the results. It's got to be about performance and nurturing these guys. And I preach that win or lose. I still say that after the game, no matter the result. So I wanted to give them that confidence and say, we have talent. We do have talent. Go out there. Make sure you respect the opposition. You know, it's not just go out there and we think we're going to be able to, you know, turn England over easily. We've got to stick rigidly to a tactical game plan. But let's see if you can do that. And let's see if you can do that in a fairly hostile environment. The band was there and the fans were getting at them and, you know, especially as we went up, it became more and more pressure on England, and it was fantastic to see just those moments in a game, those moments of an experience, the 1.5 hours before, dealing with the media, the fans, all of those experiences are just great for them to go back forwards, whether they now go back to the 17s, the 18s, the 20s, or hopefully the senior squad down the line.
Rob, how would you describe the current state of the under 20 program in terms of, you know, you talked about player development and wanting to, you know, sort of get these players up to the next level with that goal. How would you, what's the current state of the program with regards to that goal, do you think?
You know, I mean, still in the bigger picture, we're very inexperienced still. If you look at the, I think we had a conversation in between games and just talking about England, because in the first game, after 60 minutes, it was still 1-0. And we very much were trying out different things. We were pressing higher and doing some different tactical things with an eye to Sunday's game. But I think we'd only had 10 senior appearances for all of our squad. And it was a young squad, so obviously that's new. But if we're really comparing ourselves to the rest of the world, and I think you saw Lozano out there, who was in the last U20 Mexico side, and he's now playing at the first team at the Azteca and Vancouver, and he's got almost 50, 60 games under his belt. So, you know, that's what we're up against, and we can't hide behind that. We've got to keep pushing players so that the passport comes out of it, and that our young Canadian players can crack an MLS first team, can push beyond, you know, hopefully into USL Pro, NASL, and then go on to that next level. So I think as a whole, we still have a lot of work to do, but there's no question there's talent. And what we need to do is keep showcasing and providing experience for this talent that lets the coach say, yes, he will compete for that first team spot. He will be able to come in and do a job.
I was speaking to Toronto FC coach Greg Vanney earlier this week, and you know, we brought up Jordan Hamilton's performance because I think he scored a goal in the first game behind closed doors. And you know, obviously, yeah, he was pleased about Jordan's you know, the goal and getting this valuable experience with the U20 team. I'm curious, how much do you sort of are you in contact with you know, the MLS clubs when they send you their players? How much do you, like, will they say, you know, we're trying to work on Jordan with this or a certain aspect of the game? Is there that sort of dialogue, or what kind of input
Absolutely.
Do they have?
You know, it's very interesting. I think that's one of the areas that we are ahead. And Tony Fonseca and the rest of the staff, myself, Paul Stelteri, Ante Jazic now, have excellent relationships with the clubs. And part of our discussions, even bringing the younger players, is, look, this is here for development and experience to showcase the stadium. They might not necessarily make the next 20s, but we feel it's important to offer talent opportunities. And with the clubs, they're very open and honest, and we have a terrific relationship with the ID camps actually being in those MLS environments. That right the way from 15 all the way through, I would say, right up to the senior team now, and Benito and Mike and the guys have excellent relationships in that there is that two-way discussion. Because obviously what we're providing for us, I think you know, you referenced Cruyff, he used to say it was the equivalent of getting five professional matches to play in an international match. So it's very important for their development to experience different teams and different styles of play and these different hostile environments and you know, up against more experienced seasoned professionals. It's good for the club. And it's good for us. And then we follow up with reports afterwards and give them all the statistical details. They're often asking for the video. So there is a terrific relationship with the clubs, which I think has been of great benefit over the last few years with our national youth teams.
And that is refreshing to hear as well, because in previous eras, generations over here, that's always been a big issue, that the club national team relationship. So if that's improving, that's a big step in the right direction. You mentioned, you know, the step up from, you know, age grade international football and within their clubs to first team football. What is the biggest step up? What is the biggest adjustment for example, a Jordan Hamilton, who's, you know, been at his age grade for a long time, making that next step up to first team football at perhaps a professional club? Is it physicality? Is it technical skill levels? What's the biggest difference?
The biggest thing is going to be for young lads is the consistency of your performance. Mm-hmm. Because it is their job. A seasoned professional, you know, the ones who keep making it, they understand that you can't just be the best at your own age group and dominating youth football, because it's a giant leap then, each stage, 18s, 20s, etc., and you should be competing for that job. And that's now one thing you see with the MLS Academy programs, the NASL programs, you know, even with the USL and the PDL teams. What they're now starting to get the habit of is we need to be competing for a contract, and that's going to start at younger and younger ages, as you've seen. So, you know, it's hard for a youth player in Canada. Sometimes they've been the best at their club and in their province, and then they've successfully gone through the ranks, and then they get selected nationally. And I don't want to say it comes easy to them, because they have worked very hard, but certainly there's not that, you know, mass of players compared to other places in the world where they've needed that consistency every single day to apply themselves in training, which will then take them to every single game and, you know, make that career of it. And I think that's the biggest step that we're seeing, is sometimes we're a little naive, or we get success early and we think now we've arrived. And that's one thing as a youth coach, we're always trying to push and strive and say there's going to be someone younger, faster, stronger, better, who wants it a little bit more than you, coming. That's just the nature of the beast. And if we can get that into our players early, and the clubs are working very hard on this, and I think the, you know, the reserve team leagues, or the second team leagues now, I should say, are helping with that, because it is very competitive to now try and get a contract even at that second tier level. And that's what we need more of.
What's next for you and the team, Rob? You know, the FIFA U20 World Cup is next year. How soon do you now turn your attention to the CONCACAF qualifiers? What's next on your agenda?
Yes, I mean, we're still waiting for clarification on the exact dates of CONCACAF, and that's one thing we're very aware of from the last cycle. It changed quite late in the process, and we were unable to reschedule the calendar as we'd already committed to certain things. So that's why we kind of pushed back some CONCACAF events at the moment. But we will bring the squad together, not forgetting that this wasn't actually our U20 squad. We did go with a very mixed age. So the actual U20s, 1997s and 98s, who are competing four positions, we will take them into Costa Rica at the end of May. We've just confirmed two international games against them. And then we'll be looking to give different experiences. There may even be multi-age experiences again throughout the year. But we're hoping to get three or four CONCACAF camps in leading up to the qualifying, which we expect to be early in the new year.
Well, Rob, it's really refreshing and nice to talk about positive Canadian results and the future. There's hope there, certainly is bright, I think, which is wonderful to consider. Rob, as always, mate, thank you so much. Really appreciate this.
My pleasure. Thanks, James. Thanks, John. And I look forward to seeing you soon.
Cheers.
That's Canada's under-20 head coach, Rob Gale. Follow Rob on Twitter at Gailey77 underscore. Yeah. Big result, which unfortunately didn't overshadow what happened against Mexico for the national team.
Right.
But, and I put this on Twitter, and some people agreed, some people didn't. But my opinion on Canada's national men's team now is no different than it was before the game in Vancouver last week. It's the same. They were going to be overmatched. They were overmatched. It doesn't mean they can't qualify for the Hex. It doesn't mean they can't qualify for a World Cup by those two results, but it just shows the gulf is very much there.
Yeah.
And it is what it is. They're a team with deficiencies, but they're a team, I think, working in the right direction.
Yeah, it was always hard to get anything out of these two games. I know there was expectations that maybe they could get a point at home against Mexico, but
why were you saying that?
Well,
They got 4 points from Honduras and El Salvador.
Right.
That's great, and it's great.
Yeah.
But to think that on the back of that, they can get a point against Mexico?
Yeah, it was you know, the gap, I think, as you mentioned, James, was pretty big, and we saw that especially in, I thought, the first game in Vancouver. I mean, you're talking about a Mexican team that had nine members of, you know, the World Cup side from Brazil, and six starters who were in that game, the second round game against Holland for Mexico. So you're talking about that versus, and guys like you know, Andres Guardado, who plays Champions League football for PSV, comparing that to and this isn't any disrespect to Julian de Guzman, or but, you know, to NASL guys and guys who aren't necessarily playing regular first team football for their pro clubs.
Well, some players haven't got clubs,
right? Although that number is down compared to what it used to be. But the point is, you know, the golf in class was pretty evident. So for me, it was always unrealistic to expect anything to get out of these two games. You know, the good news is Canada had controls its fate going into these two games, which is what we, you know, would hope for. The bad news is that so does Honduras. They also control their fate.
I guess where they go. Going.
And they're going next to San Pedro Sula, which, you know, the last time Canada played there, it didn't turn out so well. So, yeah, I mean, look, Canada has to get something out of this game against Honduras, a draw at the very least. If they lose, then technically they're still alive and, you know, they might be able to overturn the goal difference. But if they lose in Honduras this next game, then I think they're done.
But anything less than 8-1's progress, right?
Well, you know, we joke about that, but yeah, I think it is, to be perfectly honest. I, you know, I do think this team has made small gains since, you know, the last World Cup cycle. You know, even getting the point in El Salvador, which, you know, I think a lot of people were disappointed that they didn't win because El Salvador was certainly there for the taking. But look, just getting a point in Central America and getting guys like Kyle Lahren and Tesho Akindele, you know, guys who are, you know, relatively new to the national team and don't have experience playing in Central America and in places like Azteca. This is huge.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And I've always made the argument, not that I'm writing off, you know, this World Cup cycle, although I guess I am. for me, it's always about setting the table for 2022. So let's gain some experience. Let's make some progress here. But realistically, I'm not really, you know, I think qualifying for World Cup is a long shot.
Yes. You know,
let's focus. So let's keep that in mind, but let's build towards 2022, where I think Canada has a better chance.
And maybe given what Rob was saying there, 2026 might be even more reasonable.
Right,
there
sure.
Some talent coming through there.
Right.
Right. But hey, maybe Canada's hosting that World Cup and he wants to qualify.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? that would save our qualification sort of dilemma.
I bet Julian will still be playing. He's not going to quit.
Yeah, he'll play forever.
Ageless wonder.
Well, he turned 35 on the day of the game in Vancouver. So, yeah. I mean, look, good for him. I mean, he's always been, whatever you want to say about Julian de Guzman, I think there's been a lot of criticism, but he's always answered the call for Canada. He's been a loyal sort of servant to this team. So, I mean, you've got to respect that.
He has been through the ringer.
Absolutely.
So to speak, absolutely. Always a loyal servant for his country. All right, J-Mo, we're out of time. Listen, big weekend in the Premier League and across Europe, of course, on Sportsnet. The only one on Saturday, Villa against Chelsea. Remy Gard.
There's a barn burner.
Remy Gard fired.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, mutual consent.
Mutual consent. He's on gardening duty. Is that what they call it?
Yeah, that's right.
I never understood that. You got to explain that to me.
That's more Italian, though, wasn't it? Gardening leave?
I thought it was an English thing.
I don't know where it came. Well, it sounds like it's an English saying, but in Italy, though, it very much came from we're firing you, but you're still in contract, and we'll bring you back possibly at some point.
Oh, okay. Right? Interesting.
And yeah, well, I guess Chelsea, it means nothing whatsoever. Maybe David Moyes will be at the Villa helm in the next few weeks, which is
I never even thought about that.
Yeah,
wow.
Be a good fit, or Nigel Pearson,
or Gary Neville.
No, go back to the TV studio, Gary. You do a great job there. Bayern Munich against who's it? Is it Effenberg?
I think it's Frankfurt, isn't it?
Is it? I don't know who it is. Is Effenberg even a team? No, Stefan Effenberg was a player once.
Yeah,
upon
the
time. I saw on my notes EF. It must be Frankfurt.
Frankfurt.
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, thank you. 9:30 Eastern. That's in Sportsnet World. We have Bournemouth against Man City. Another must win for City at 9:30 on Sportsnet. West Ham, Crystal Palace on Sportsnet 1. The Hammers eyeing fourth place. Oh, football on Saturday.
Yeah,
Dortmund against Bremen, Sportsnet World at noon.
Yeah.
And also at noon on Sportsnet 1, Liverpool Spurs.
Yeah.
Youch, that's a good one.
Yeah, it should be a good one. Yeah, really looking forward to that. Spurs are, you know, dynamite, and they're, you know, obviously Kane and Dyer and some guys who did well for England.
Very well for England, right? Yeah. Didn't even get to talk about England and Italy this podcast, did we?
No, we'll save that.
Smashed by Germany. England beating Germany. So clearly England's better than Italy.
I like that logic, yeah, sure.
Makes a lot of sense. All right,
sure.
Hope you enjoyed that. Our thanks to Thomas Rongan and to Rob Gale. For John Molinaro, I'm James Sherman. Cheers for listening.